You're doing? Are you not Adinadana? No, is that no? No, sorry. What's it? Okay, thank you. I was already breaking a precept. I thought I will. Yeah, full house, is it? Okay, please come in. Please enter the full house. Of course, yeah. And all spaces need to be occupied. Yeah. Yeah.
In front.
What about the devas? We have to have a bit of room for the devas in front. Yeah, the devas have to be. Yeah. Always leave a few places for the devas. Yeah. Anyway, oh, that's really good. That's a really good position, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, great. Okay. So let's get started here. So today is Vaisak Eve. Tomorrow is Vaisakhya, and tomorrow we're going to be talking about the Buddha himself, the life of the Buddha, and what he did, and who he was, and the qualities of the Buddha, and all of these kind of things. So because of that is tomorrow, I thought today it might be useful to talk about how did the Buddha become the Buddha, so we're kind of leading up the excitement, and tomorrow we find out who he really was. Yeah. So today we kind of build up the excitement for tomorrow. And so this is the idea behind tonight's talk, is to find out why there is a Buddha in the first place. How did he arise? How do these things actually happen? And this is not just kind of interesting for theoretical reasons, because it's interesting to know about the history of Buddhism and all of this. It is actually very interesting and very exciting, because the way the Buddha, or the Buddha-to-be, became the Buddha is basically exactly the same way that we all practice the spiritual path. Yeah, we become arahants. Any arahants here tonight? Not yet. Soon. Arahants to be, yeah, we become arahants. Whatever progress we make on the spiritual path is because we are pursuing roughly the same things that the Buddha himself pursued before he became the Buddha. So if we understand a little bit more about the life of the Buddha and the sort of things that he did to get where he was, we will also understand more about what we have to do. Yeah, it's always useful to know about what we have to do to make progress on this path. It's difficult enough as it is. We need to not have maximum kind of clarity about what needs to be done. And this already is one of the interesting things about Buddhism, is that very often the Buddha talks about his own life and how he did things. He talks about his own practice. It's like what I would call autobiographical suttas, where the Buddha's kind of giving his autobiography. Yeah, and then now we have this big autobiography called the suttas. And some of them are very specific about how the Buddha lived and how he practiced and what he did. And to look at some of those suttas to try to understand how the Buddha actually came about. So to start off, the traditional way that it is said that the Buddha came into existence was because of the Bodhisattva vows. Yeah, he kind of took this vow a long time ago, many eons ago, and then he practiced the paramis. Yeah, this paramis is one of these words that you find in the commentaries. You don't actually find it in the suttas. You find it in the commentaries that describe the practices the Buddha undertook to reach awakening. Here, this is a traditional way of thinking about Bodhisattvas and Buddhas and how actually Buddhas arise in the world. And that traditional way is not actually taught by the Buddha himself, which is very interesting. The traditional way is rather taught by later generations of Buddhists. You find it in the commentaries, you find it in the later suttas, such as some of the Mahayana suttas and these kind of things. But if you go back to the very earliest teachings, there's nothing there really about the Bodhisattva ideal. And yet somehow it emerges out of the Bodhisattva, out of the early suttas. It comes from that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that before I get on to the kind of main idea about how the Buddha became the Buddha. So how did the Bodhisattva ideal arise? If it is not from the Buddha, where did it come from? And there's two things that it comes from that is already in the suttas, and both of these concepts are quite interesting. That's why I want to talk about them briefly at least. And one of those concepts is the idea of there being many Buddhas. The idea of there being many Buddhas is actually something that belongs to the very earliest suttas, and I will explain to you in a second why that is the case and how it works. And the other idea is the idea of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva, the word Bodhisattva, actually occurs in the earlier suttas. The Buddha himself says, before my awakening, while I was still only a Bodhisattva, so the word is there. So if the word is already there in the early suttas, what does it actually mean? If it doesn't mean this person who practiced over a large number of eons, who took the vow to become a Buddha under the Buddha Dipankara many eons ago, then what exactly does it mean in the early suttas? These are the sources for the later development of the Bodhisattva ideal, as it then came to be expanded and developed a long time after the Buddha. These two ideals, first of all, the idea of many Buddhas, is actually one of those core things that you find in Buddhism, which to me makes the Buddhist teaching come alive and makes it meaningful. And sometimes you find in the sutta that the Buddha will say that, for example, he will talk about Buddhas of the past and Buddhas of the future. And because it talks about Buddhas of the past and Buddhas of the future, he obviously is referring to this idea that there are many Buddhas. Whether that Buddha of the future is called Maitreya, whether Buddhas in the past were called Kassapa and Vipassi, may be uncertain. But the general idea that there are Buddhas both in the past and future, that general idea is right there in the suttas. Why is that? And this is kind of interesting. This is one of the things that makes the Buddhist religion or the Buddhist teaching different from any other kind of spiritual teaching. In many spiritual teachings around the world, you find that there is like one savior, and that savior happens to have arisen just at the right time, just now. We happen to be around, and the savior is now, and then you have to believe in that savior, and then you go to heaven or something like that. It's kind of one of the traditional ways of thinking about religion around the world. And to me, there's always something slightly self-centered about that. The savior happens to rise just when we are here. But those people who were born before that savior, well, they didn't have any chance, because they didn't have any chance to believe in someone who hadn't arisen yet. But now the savior is there. Now we have this opportunity to kind of be saved and to be happy because of that savior. But Buddhism isn't like that. In Buddhism, there isn't like one particular time. Now is the time you have the chance to be saved from suffering or whatever, because now the savior is present. Rather, in Buddhism, this idea of a savior, of a Buddha is someone that arises at natural intervals. Every now and again, someone has the right qualities, and they rise in the world, and they become a Buddha. There isn't one particular period. These things happen at regular intervals. From a Buddhist point of view, there's not one savior. There is like occasionally there will be someone who has the qualities it takes to make the breakthrough. So it is like a natural principle. A natural principle that every now and again a Buddha arrives in the world and gives you the opportunity to find the end of suffering and to find the highest happiness. And these are the kind of things that to me make Buddhism like a universal religion. It is not limited to one time and place, to one particular culture. Imagine, take Christianity, because Christianity is an obvious case of that kind of religion where you have one savior. Christianity started out in the Middle East about 2,000 years ago. What if you, and it stayed in that area for many hundreds of years afterwards, only recently has it come to Asia and other parts of the world. So what about all those people who were born in Asia before Christianity got here? They were lost. They didn't have any chance. There was no hope, because this was the only savior, and you were kind of, that was it. And to me, that is so strange. It doesn't fit. It's not the kind of universal principle that applies to all people at all times. But the idea that things come and go, they float, and suddenly you have a Buddha rising, the Buddha disappearing, giving everybody a chance while the Buddha is there. Another time the Buddha may arise somewhere else, a different person, giving other people a chance. It's a regular thing. It's a rhythm of the universe. The universe follows a certain rhythm, a certain way of working. And that, to me, is a far more satisfactory explanation of things. There's little things like that that, to me, make Buddhism special and make it unique among philosophies and religions around the world. And this is only one example. Another example that I sometimes like to bring up as well is the example of the universe. Yeah, according to modern science, the universe began at the Big Bang. Yeah, there was a famous physicist who said that we can explain everything about the universe. We know exactly how it works. Yeah, from the very first point of the Big Bang, we can explain how it expands. You have a period of inflation, it kind of goes very rapidly, and then it kind of continues to expand after that. And now we have this state. We know kind of the laws that brought us here. There's only one problem. Yeah, we don't know how it began. So give us one miracle, and we can explain everything else. This was the physicist, yeah, this was one of the most famous physicists around the world, said, give us one miracle. And I thought, Buddhists, we can do better. Yeah, and because from a Buddhist point of view, there is no first point. Yeah, the Big Bang itself is just one of many Big Bangs, one of many universes. Because of that, from a Buddhist point of view, there is no first point. There is no first Big Bang. It all arose because of cause and conditions that go into the past, prior to that Big Bang. In other words, from a Buddhist point of view, you have this kind of sequence of universes. Yeah, Big Bang, big crunches or whatever, or something like that. A sequence anyway, one coming after the other. We know first cause, no first condition that started everything off. And to me, again, that is a far more satisfactory explanation than the idea of suddenly everything coming out of nothing, which is very hard to explain, yeah, unless you kind of make it into a miracle, which even the scientists want sometimes. And that is kind of is problematic. So this is another example where I find the Buddhist teaching actually gives a very satisfactory explanation of what something science hasn't really yet. Maybe science will explain it, but hasn't yet given a satisfactory explanation to her. So this is kind of how Buddhism operates. It operates on the basis of cycles going through long time spans, things repeating themselves, going round and around in cycles, things coming back to where they were before, roughly in the same way. Yeah, it's cycles, but with a slight variation, and going around in this way. And this is how it operates. And the idea of a Buddha is exactly like that. So how does a Buddha arise then? What is a Buddha if this is the case? And what the Buddha is, and this may sound like blasphemy. Do we have blasphemy in Buddhism? A Buddha is like a natural phenomenon. Yeah, a Buddha is a natural phenomenon. It is really a certain cause and conditions coming together, a certain personality who kind of is able somehow, yeah, more or less through accident, to build up all the right conditions within themselves and also conditions outside. And when all the conditions come together, then someone is able to break through and to see reality as it actually is. And that is what the Buddha really is. So a Buddha comes along, yeah? Why? Because the cause and conditions are right. And then someone has the insight and bang, then you have a Buddha in the world. But there is no path, yeah? And this is kind of the point. The Buddha, after his awakening, he taught only one path, and the path that he taught is the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path leads to arahantship. It leads to awakening. But there isn't really any path to becoming a Buddha. Or the Buddha didn't teach any path to become the Buddha. So if the Buddha didn't teach it, then who has the authority to teach that kind of path? Yeah, the Buddha is really the person who has the highest authority. If he doesn't teach that path, then you may wonder what it arises out of. And there are some very good reasons to think that this idea of the Bodhisattva ideal doesn't really work or doesn't really fit with what we know about the Buddhist teachings. The idea of being, you know, born eons and eons ago and practicing and perfecting yourself. First thing is not found in the early suttas. The Buddha doesn't teach it. That's really enough. Yeah, that's kind of, for me, that's enough to say that this is a later expansion, a later evaluation. Another thing is some of the suttas some of the places where the Buddha talks about this. According to one sutta, the Buddha is supposed to have met one of the early Buddhas, Buddha Kassapa. And when he met the early Buddha, he didn't become his disciple straight away and say, yeah, I'm going to practice under you because I know I'm on the Bodhisattva path, so I need to practice under you and perfect myself. No, he didn't say that. Instead, he disparaged the previous Buddha. He didn't sound like somebody who was practicing towards awakening over many eons. He sounded like someone who was clueless. Yeah, sounded like someone like a bit like us. We're kind of fumbling in the dark, trying to find the path, trying to find the way through the suffering and problems of life, finding some happiness and contentment. That is what it sounded like. And again, it is one of those things that shows you that the traditional Bodhisattva ideal is very problematic from a kind of a later Buddhist point of view. So that is the idea of multiple Buddhas, which makes sense, but the idea that there should be a path to becoming a Buddha, actually, it doesn't fit with the teachings of the Buddha himself. But there is this other thing that I mentioned at the very beginning, and this is the idea of the Bodhisattva as it is talked about in the suttas. It is interesting when the Buddha says, before my awakening, yeah, Pubbe me sambodha, which means before my awakening. I always like to put in a few Pali words because it sounds impressive when I do that. So just to kind of get more authority, yeah, as a teacher, you have to have a bit of authority. That's how you get your authority here. So, and he says, before my awakening, while I was still only a bodhisatta. So what does that mean? Why does he use this word bodhisatta if it is a later idea that kind of developed later on? And the reason he uses that, this word, is only used in the suttas after the Buddha goes forth from the home life. Yeah, so from the moment he goes forth from the home life, he renounces kind of the ordinary life, and until he becomes the Buddha, that period is the Bodhisatta. Why is that period called the Bodhisatta? And, well, it depends a bit on the meaning of the word Bodhisatta, because the word Bodhisatta usually in Sanskrit is translated as Bodhisattva. Yeah, we're dealing with two slightly different languages here, Pali and Sanskrit. And Bodhisattva is the Sanskrit word, whereas Bodhisatta is the Pali word. Now, the Sanskrit word Bodhisattva means something like enlightenment being. Bodhi means enlightenment or awakening, and Sattva means being. And enlightenment being is a little bit strange. Enlightenment being, what does that mean? Enlightenment being, it can mean many things maybe, but it's not entirely clear what it means. So it has been proposed, I think this is by someone called Richard Gombrich, who used to be the professor in Sanskrit at Oxford University for a long time, and I know him a little bit because the Buddhist world is a small world, yeah, so we're in contact with everybody pretty much. Actually, not everybody, there's too many Buddhists for that, but, you know, some Buddhists anyway. And he proposed, and very reasonably, that there is an alternative meaning in Sanskrit to bodhisatta, another word which matches the idea of bodhisatta, and that is bodhisakta. And bodhisakta in Sanskrit means someone who is intent on awakening. That makes really good sense, yeah? You get reborn in this life, then you do your, you know, you live your household life, you're not satisfied with the household life, you see the problems, then the intention to awaken arises to find the solution to the problems, then as a consequence of that intention, eventually you find awakening. The whole thing fits together very well. And that is the early meaning of the word bodhisatta or bodhisattva in the early suttas. Yeah, it is the idea of bodhisakta, of someone who is intent on awakening because they have given up the household life in the very last life before they become a Buddha. That is where it is applicable and not before that. Does that make sense? Yeah, and this kind of then, everything comes together in a very nice way. You will notice that I always talk about the early suttas, yeah, and because that is really where you find the word of the Buddha. And of course, to me, the word of the Buddha is what matters. Everything else is secondary here. So then, what happened then? It's kind of interesting to think about also what happened. Why did this idea of the Bodhisattva who practiced through many eons or whatever, why did it even arise? Why is that kind of become the almost like the default understanding in Buddhism of how the Buddha came about? Why did that happen? And to understand that, what you have to understand is you have to understand a little bit about the life of the Buddha himself. Yeah, you can imagine the Buddha, he became the teacher of so many people around India, thousands, yeah, maybe lots and lots of people, that he would became a fairly large religion during the time of the Buddha himself. 45 years he was teaching here in India. And then as he taught, and as gradually he was becoming older, and towards the end of his life, the way he is described in the sutras is very interesting. He's becoming very fragile. Yeah, his body is falling apart. He's talking about his skin becoming flaccid. He's kind of losing his natural kind of clarity in the faculties, like the faculties, your eyes and hearing. Everything starts to become weaker as you get older, and as you get close to death, it becomes very weak. And the Buddha is described in this way in the suttas. It's obviously that he's aging like anyone else. And as the Buddha is aging, on one occasion, he almost dies. Yeah, and Venerable Ananda, who is an attendant, becomes very distraught because he sees the Buddha almost dying. Yeah? And then he says to the Buddha, after the Buddha kind of comes out of the illness, using energy, whatever, to kind of come out of it again, he says to the Buddha that, I was so distraught. I felt like I was drunk. I couldn't see clearly. Why? Because I could see that you were ill, and I was afraid you were going to pass away. Yeah. And then Venerable Ananda says, well, but I consoled myself by thinking, you will surely address the Sangha and say something about who is going to take over after you. It's like a corporation, yeah? Someone's going to take over after you before you pass away here. And of course the Buddha says, I'm not going to say anything about anyone taking over after me. That's not the way I work. I don't operate on a kind of corporation basis. So he didn't say that. That's what I added here. Yeah. And so you can see here how the Sangha, how the people, how Venerable Ananda, who was even a stream mentor at this time, everyone was kind of grieving. Yeah, they were saying, wow, what's going to happen? What are we going to do? Here is the master has been doing everything for us for 45 years. Every tiny little problem, we go to him and he sorts it out for us. Poor Buddha, right? Every tiny problem, yeah, they go to him. Oh, imagine, thousands of people. You know someone like Ajahn Brahm, he goes, oh, so many people give me headaches. The Buddha, many, many more headaches than Ajahn Brahm. This is the dukkha of being kind of in that kind of position. So for the Buddha, probably really happy, I'm going to die soon. Oh, finally. Everyone else is kind of distraught. So, anyway, everyone is distraught, and you can see why that is the case. This is the greatest spiritual master in human history here. Yeah, this is what the Buddha is. In recorded human history, unfortunately, we don't have the unrecorded human history, but if we had even the unrecorded human history, he would still be the greatest spiritual master, at least going a long way here. So, and he's about to die here. The person who has given you essentially access to the very meaning of life, the person who has given you access to the highest happiness, to the end of all suffering, to everything that is really useful, who basically resolves all the issues in the Sangha, you can imagine what it feels like when a person that is going to die. I know what Singapore felt like when Lee Kuan Yew died a few years ago, yeah? That was a little bit like that. It was like the father of Singapore dying, and everyone was lining up to say goodbye, and everyone was sad, because he was a very towering figure in Singapore. But the Buddha, even more towering, yeah? Even more so, because he had the answers, much deeper answers. Okay, Lee Kuan Yew, he led Singapore really well, but the Buddha had the answer to the very meaning of life, even more profound. So you can imagine what happens when someone like that dies. What happens when someone like that dies is that everybody feels a bit distraught. After the Buddha has died, they start to think about, well, who was he really? Who was this person? How did he get to become the Buddha in the first place? And then from that, the legends and the mythology of the Buddha starts to arise. It starts to arise with the seed of these legends are actually found in the suttas. So like I said just before, the idea of the Bodhisattva is already there. And from that seed arises the stories and the legends of the later Buddha. And how he then took the Bodhisattva vow under Buddha Dipankara 27 Buddhas ago, and then over four incalculable eons or whatever, he then eventually became the Buddha. That's where it comes from. It comes from that emptiness, yeah, the aching heart which has lost something that is so close to you, and a gap, a hole in people's lives that needs to be filled. And that hole and gap in people's lives is filled by the stories, by the memory of who they thought that Buddha was a long time ago. It's not really fake. It's just that they are kind of, you know, they are kind of using a little bit of imagination to fill the holes that is actually there. And this is how it actually comes about. There's a very interesting book for those of you who are really keen on these kind of things. I don't know if, how many of you are keen, but if you are keen, there's something called the book called The Origin of the Bodhisattva Ideal. And this book is written by a monk called Venerable Anālaya, and you can look it up online. It's available as a PDF. So he doesn't charge for his books. He's a monk. And it's a very Venerable Anālaya, The Origin of the Bodhisattva Ideal. Very nice book, which shows you how the Bodhisattva Ideal emerges from the early suttas and then becomes the de facto reality in the Buddhist world after that. It's important to know that it's not the Bodhisattva ideal. It's not just a Mahayana ideal, the Mahayana Buddhism. Bodhisattva ideal is also found in Theravada Buddhism as well. It's a bit, little bit like Mahayana Buddhism came up with the Bodhisattva ideal, and then Theravada had to compete. Yeah, wow, big, you got the Bodhisattva ideal. Okay, we better get it as well. It was a little bit like that. That was Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's, I think, theory, and based on some facts that this is how it actually arose. And the Mahayanas, they had 6 paramis, yeah? Theravada, 10 paramis, even better, yeah? So kind of, we have 4 more paramis, kind of perfect, become a Buddha. So this is kind of a competition. You can see when good ideas arise, yeah? Somehow you have to kind of keep up with the Joneses. You said in Singapore, keeping up with the Joneses? Yeah? Yeah? Okay. I thought keep up with the Tans maybe or something like that in Singapore. I don't know. Anyway. So this is how it all came about. And this is very likely to be the story. Of course, there's always a little bit of speculation in these things. But that is how it actually very likely came about. So if the Buddha is a natural phenomenon, it sounds a bit kind of dodgy to say that a Buddha is a natural phenomenon. You risk becoming a very unpopular monk if you say that in the wrong circles. But anyway, I say the Buddha is like a natural phenomenon. By the way, so am I. I'm also a natural phenomenon. So are you, yeah? Everyone here is a natural phenomenon. So we're all the same, basically, just that we have kind of slightly different karma to kind of end up slightly differently. But we're all natural phenomena. So how then did the Buddha actually, what happened with the Buddha? How did he actually come about? How did he eventually reach his awakening state? That's what this talk is supposed to be about. If you read the suttas, in the suttas you find, as I said, some of the Buddha's autobiography. He talks about his own early life. And it's quite interesting to read that. There's only short passages that actually talk about how he experienced his childhood, his youth, his upbringing, and all of these things. And one place, one of the very few places where he talks about this, he says that when I grew up in great luxury. Doesn't say, yeah, in reasonable luxury, yeah, in great luxury. Yeah. When I was a child, I had cloth from Benares. That was the best cloth you could have in those days from Benares. If you go to Benares today, it still is pretty much the same best cloth in India. 2,500 years later, nothing really has changed in India, still the same. That's the feeling you get when you go there, see all the ruins. Yeah, this has been the same for 2,500 years. And he had the cloth from Benares, and he had 3 lotus ponds. One with blue lotuses, one with red lotuses, one with white lotuses. That was how young men enjoyed themselves 2,500 years ago. Lotus ponds, yeah? Whoa, change, yeah? Anicca. Now, it's not. How many young men enjoy themselves with lotus ponds these days? Not so many. Things have changed, yeah? Okay. Spas, more like spas. Okay, spas. That's for old people, isn't it? Anyway, whatever. So, he grew up in a fair amount of luxury, not the kind of luxury that you find in later tradition where he was a prince and his father was the king and Kapilavati was this enormous capital. That is all later legends, yeah? It was fairly small. It was quite humble. He had 3 houses, one for the rainy season, one for the hot season, one for the cold season, yeah? These were stilt houses, not really palaces as it is sometimes described. It was fairly simple. He had nice food, yeah? He had what was it called? Choice hill rice and meat. Yeah, this was kind of luxury food in those days. And also, what was nice about it, one of the little kind of details in there. It also says that not only did he have that, but that was also given to the workers and slaves in the family. So it was a compassionate household where you look after the workers, you looked after everybody. It wasn't just, I am the boss, I am the master, so I have the best, but you guys, you kind of get, you know, the dodgy food. It was a compassionate place. And that kind of makes sense, yeah, that the Buddha should grow up in a kind household where his parents and everyone was kind and compassionate. And then there's a small little detail that I maybe should kind of also bring out straight away before I forget about it. And that is when the Buddha eventually decides to go forth. I'll come back to this in a second, why he does that. When he decides to go forth, it says in the sutta, this is in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Sutta on the Noble Search. If you want to look it up, Majjhima Nikaya, Middle Length Sayings, number 26. This is all from there, so you can actually look it up and see if I'm telling the truth or not. And if I'm not telling the truth, you can complain to Ai Ling and say, why are you inviting these dodgy monks to come to Singapore? Anyway, I'm sorry, maybe I'm creating a lot of work for you, Ai Ling, but... So in the sutta, it's quite nice. The Buddha says that even though my parents wished otherwise, and even though my parents were crying, I still went forth. And this is actually very interesting, because the traditional way that the Buddha is said to have gone forth, he said that he rode off in the middle of the night, he had a last look at his wife and child while they were sleeping, got onto the horse Kantaka, and then rode out of the city Kapalamata, jumping over the high walls, and saying goodbye. Very dramatic, like some kind of Hollywood movie or something like that. But of course, that's not what happened. You read the sutta, that's actually what happened. His mother and father had expressed their wish that they didn't want it, they wished otherwise, and they were crying. He had consulted with them, obviously, and asked them, what do you feel about this? They weren't too happy, just like most parents aren't too happy when the children go forth. My parents weren't very happy at all when I decided to become a monk, but I did it anyway. Yay! I'm really stubborn, And actually, it turned out really, really well later on. Initially, it was a bit difficult, but it turned out really, really well. I won't get into that now. So the Buddha also was a bit stubborn, You have to be a bit stubborn, because if you do everything your mother, your parents say, sometimes it is not right. Sometimes you have to be a bit stubborn, I'm going to get very unpopular with the parents. I'm sure the parents agree, because all the parents, you have also been children once. You know that it is important sometimes to kind of follow your own inner drive sometimes. Actually, it's very important occasionally to do that. But anyway, so he had consulted with his parents. He obviously had made sure that his child and his wife were being looked after. Very often it is said that the Buddha was selfish. And sometimes they use this as conversion tactic. In poor countries like Sri Lanka, the Christians will go there and they will say, you're Buddha, he just left his child and wife like that, it's selfish, And the village says, you're right. Actually, it says in the sutta, doesn't it? Buddha was no good. Why did he do that for? Actually, he didn't do it. It's a false story. It's a false lead. So actually, sometimes you read the suttas, you get a different impression that Buddha was responsible. He wasn't irresponsible. He made sure everyone was looked after. That's kind of little details like that. Actually, it sometimes changes the way we think about the Buddha and we think about Buddhism. Little things like that. So anyway, what I'm really talking about is why he became the Buddha. So what happened? He was living this luxurious life. He was enjoying his lotus ponds. Then he started to look at reality. He started looking at the world outside. And he saw that there is a problem here. And he saw, and this is why this particular sutta is called the Noble Search. Because he realized, one day I'm going to have to die. And one day I'm going to have to die, and yet, even though I'm going to die, I go out into the world, and I look for other things that are also going to die. I'm looking for a wife and children. I'm looking for all these material possessions. Gold, silver, cattle, horses. This was kind of the wealth in those days. I'm looking for all of that. I'm looking for all of these things that also have a dying date. All of these things will have to disappear. You cannot hold on to these things. One day everything dies, and material possessions, they also tend to disappear. So in that sense, they too die. So why am I, when I am about to die myself, and it's not that far into the future, why am I pursuing all these other things that also are going to die? And he realized this is madness, this is crazy, because if you pursue other things that are going to die, and in that pursuit, because it is important to you, you attach to it. Yeah, you know what it is like. If you get into a relationship, you get attached. If you have children, you're going to get attached. If you have belongings, you're going to get attached. If you're not attached to your belongings, and if someone takes it, oh yeah, no worries, just take it. Yeah, the fact that you don't say that means you have some attachment to your belongings. So we are attached to these things. So going into the world, attaching to all of these things, knowing that one day they're going to have to be taken from you, he realized this is crazy. What am I doing this for? And then he knew that I have to look for another solution in life. And that solution is to actually find the end of death, the solution to death. That is what then drove the Buddha to become, or the Buddha to become the Buddha. It's kind of astonishing. When you read the suttas carefully, you realize this is the main insight or the main understanding the Buddha had before his awakening that actually drove him to become a monastic. The idea of death. We're all going to have to die one day. Yeah, I'm going to have to die. Everything in my life is going to have to disappear. That was the main thing that drove the Buddha forward. And that's kind of extraordinary. Because what that means... what that means is that 2,500 years of Buddhist history, 2,500 years of people using these teachings to improve their lives, to become more happy, to overcome suffering, 2,500 years of the Buddhist teaching moving from one culture to another one, from one era to another era, all of that is the result of one thing, one person thinking very deeply about death. That is the power of death contemplation. Sometimes we talk about death contemplation in the suttas and we don't really quite understand how profound it is. It is sufficient to start the entire Buddhist history, yeah, in the world. That is how powerful it is. And if we think about it in that way, we can actually make far more out of this kind of contemplation in our lives when we understand how powerful it is and what the potential for transformation is with a simple thing like death contemplation. It is only those people who are not going to die who don't have to use death contemplation. So if you're not going to die, then no worries, you can chill. But if you're going to die, then yeah, then it's good. It's a good thing to do. And it will have that power and ability to change you as a consequence. So this is what happened to the Buddha. And this is how he then gradually practiced and tried to find a way. You can imagine how hard it is. There is no path. Yeah, we are all handed the noble eiffel path. Here you are, practice it. Still we can't get awakened. Yeah, still it's hard enough. The Buddha didn't have anything. He had to kind of fumble around in the dark. So of course, for the Buddha, there were many other things that were very helpful for him in developing the path. One thing was the fact that he had the death contemplation, but there were other things that made it possible for him to make that breakthrough. And one of the things that was very powerful for the Buddha was that he had a deep meditation experience as a child. Yeah, you may remember that from the Buddha biography. When he was a child, while his father was working in the field, he was sitting under a tree, and then spontaneously he went into a jhana state. And that, of course, once you go into a jhana state, you have seen something different. You have seen an alternative to ordinary existence. You have seen what the mind is like when it withdraws completely from the ordinary human realm of the five senses. And because you have seen that, you know the happiness that is beyond attachment and beyond craving. And that, of course, is very helpful. And this is one of the reasons why a little bit of meditation practice that draws the mind out of ordinary existence can be incredibly powerful to give you a different alternative view of life and of existence itself. Because you have to kind of pull back a little bit and you have to get out of the water like the tadpole getting out of the water when it becomes a frog. You have to get out of the water of ordinary existence to understand some of the alternatives. And that is what the Buddha had from beforehand. And that, of course, was then a contributing factor to his ability to understand death, yeah, and why death is problematic. Another big advantage the Buddha had, and all of these things are kind of useful to think about because it gives us some idea of why perhaps Buddhism works today, why it does not work. one of the things the Buddha had, he had a society that already valued ascetics. Yeah, in that day, they had people, lots of people going forth all the time. They were full ascetics of society, all kind of strange religions, wanderers wandering around proclaiming all kind of random and crazy ideas. But occasionally, it was a really good idea, yeah, like the Buddhism coming around. And so there was a culture of ascetics, of samanas wandering around, being supported by the people, yeah, coming with little alms bowls, and people putting rice in, and putting food into the bowl, and then you lived on that, and you lived in the forest. And people were respected for that. So having a society where ascetics and samanas and monks and nuns are respected is already a great advantage. This is not always given. Yeah, in some societies, if I come as a Buddhist monk, they think I'm nuts. What are you wearing that for? Yeah, get a real job or something like that. So it's actually very useful to have a society where people are respected and you can practice this path. So this is what they had in ancient India. And this is what I love about India. I don't know about you, but I love India. It's such a different country, yeah, from what you're used to. Everything is really in your face. And people are, for those of you who've been to India, you know what I'm talking about. They still have a great respect for monks. And I said, when you go to India, you feel like you fit in straight away. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I'm kind of at home here in India because India's full of kind of wanderers wandering around and weirdos doing weird stuff just like we are doing. So it's kind of the same kind of thing here. So that kind of society is actually very useful. And not only that kind of society, but the kind of ascetics that you have, people who actually practice in the right way. So when the Buddha went forth, the very first thing that he did, not the Buddha to be went forth, one of the very first things that he did was to seek out existing spiritual masters who already existed. Alara Kalama, Uddaka Ramaputta, for those of you, some of you will know those names because you have read some of the suttas. And these were the teachers of the Buddha, and they had very profound samadhi. And because they had very profound samadhi, they knew how to still the mind, to prepare it for anything beyond. Kind of the basic foundation of the spiritual practice already existed. And it gave the Buddha the foundation that made it possible later on to make the breakthrough and become the Buddha. So all of these conditions, yeah, have to kind of fall into place somehow. And when they all fall into place, then it is possible to make that breakthrough. But the one thing that was really important was the idea of death. Yeah, understanding that death is a problem. And the more you reflect on that, the more you will understand why it is a problem. Because if you think about death in the right way, it will change your perspective on life. Your priorities will change. They will tend to turn upside down. You start to understand the importance of the spiritual life, why the spiritual life is so important. Because that is ultimately, when you are on your deathbed, that is what will matter. And all the things that you have done in this world, it will disappear. You can't hold on to it. All you have left is the spiritual qualities that you have built up during this life. That is what goes with you into the future. But it is quite amazing and it's quite astonishing to think about the Buddha because the audacity, yeah, of saying, yeah, I'm going to solve death. It's pretty kind of, people don't normally think about that. I'm going to solve death and kind of sort it out. You will note here that the Buddha didn't decide to go forth out of compassion. This is part of the mythology of the Buddha, of the Bodhisattva. He has compassion for everyone in the world and decides to go forth to help everyone out. There's nothing in the early suttas about that. The reason he goes forth is because there's a problem. That problem is called death. And now I'm going to solve death. It's kind of amazing, yeah, it's kind of really audacious, and it's kind of obviously a very high self-belief there. Not arrogance at all, I don't think that's what it is, but it's the belief, or at least going to try out to see if this incredible problem can be solved. And that is what the Buddha is about. And then, after he has solved it, that is when the compassion arises, because then he knows he has found the solution to life and death, and then, of course, compassion arises. Then you share what you have found with humanity. That is where compassion fits in. Compassion does not fit in until you have resolved the problem. How can you have compassion if you haven't even solved the problem yet? It doesn't make sense. You have to get things in the right order. So this is the idea of why the Buddha became the Buddha. And I'm just going to maybe finish off a little bit by saying a little bit about my own life and how I have used this in my own experience, because it is very useful, and it's, of course, the way the Buddha did it, it's actually very profound, but it can be used also in much simpler ways. Yeah, and one of the things that I decided fairly early on after I started reading about the death contemplation and understanding that life is short, and especially after some of my family members got cancer and that sort of thing. Yeah, my father got cancer a few years ago, and some of the people here in the BF very kindly collected money and sent me off to Europe, yeah, so I could have a chance to visit my parents. That was a very kind and very noble gesture. Yeah. So, but because I started realizing these problems, I started to realize that actually it's important to live well with everyone around you. Because if death is a possibility, an ever-present possibility all the time, it is important that you always treat people well. Yeah, if this is the last time I see you today, maybe it's the last time I see you today, Pinha. Yeah, who knows? Maybe this is the last time. I can't treat you badly. I have to treat you with kindness. Yeah, and if you think every day, every time you meet someone, this could be the last time I see you, how are you going to treat people? You're going to generally treat people well. You don't want to end up in an argument and never have a chance of making up again. Yeah, and a man I met many years ago when I went to Brisbane in Australia. I travel around Australia also sometimes. And he said to me that every day when I leave for work, I remind myself, this could be the last time I say goodbye to my wife and children. I could die today on the way to work or whatever. I'm going to say goodbye to my wife and children in a good way. Same kind of thing. So the idea of death, one of the things that it does, which is very powerful, it reminds you always to treat people well, because it could be the last time you see them. And if that is all it does, it's already very profound and incredibly useful, if you can keep that at the back of your mind. And this is what I started to do also, well, with everyone really, but especially with my family members. Yeah, my mother and father, who weren't very keen on me going forth and becoming a monk. I thought, what can I do about this? Well, all I can really do is to practice in the right way. Not try to convert them and make them into Buddhists. I'm going to make them even more averse to Buddhism. Yeah, you know what it's like if you try to convert someone to, and it's too obvious it's coming from your desire rather than from their need. So actually, no, let me instead treat them well. So I started to do that. I reminded myself of death, and I reminded myself, especially when my father then eventually got his cancer and the things kind of going down, 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 and eventually he died only a few weeks ago. And then when my father eventually died, I felt at ease with it. It wasn't a big problem because we had a really good relationship. Yeah, it took a long time to turn him around and to turn myself around perhaps as well. But eventually the relationship blossomed and became incredibly good. We were really good friends towards the end. We talked about meditation practice. We meditated together. We talked about Buddhist teachings and all of these things. And he was pretty much a Buddhist towards the end. Yeah, he hated Buddhism when I became a monk. And after 20 years, he was a Buddhist. That's how things can turn around. And this came basically from this idea of death contemplation. Yeah, reminding yourself of what matters in life, thinking about people in the right way, treating them in the right way, especially the people who are closest to you. And then when I went back to Norway, because I went back and I was very happy, I was actually the one who presided over the funeral service. It was a very nice thing to do, yeah, to preside over your own father's funeral service. Not many people get that chance. You really have to be a monk or something to be able to get that opportunity. So I did that. It's a wonderful opportunity. Yeah, the last chance to say goodbye to your father, to thank him for all of his support. He was a very good father. So very easy to thank him and coming from genuine gratitude. And then wishing him well on the journey onwards. Yeah, may you be well and happy, Father, whatever you are now. It's a very beautiful thing to do. And so I did that. And the other thing that was kind of remarkable about this whole funeral service was that obviously there was about 300 people there, so it was a large funeral service, and I knew most of the people, yeah, so you never know what's going to happen when you kind of have to kind of do the funeral service for your own father. It's a bit different than from doing it for a stranger, yeah, it's kind of a different feeling to it. So I knew most of the people there, my whole family was there, everyone was there. It's a bit nerve-wracking, yeah. It's different. One thing is talking to people you don't know that well. Another one, when you know everyone. But actually, it wasn't such a big problem. And what was one of the things that was really
nice about it. I didn't make it very religious because nobody there was Buddhist except for me. I was the only Buddhist in the whole assembly. Yeah. Everyone else was like atheist or whatever. Yeah. They had no religion except for BMWs or whatever they do these days. But, you know, so they, so I did the service. I didn't make it very, very religious. But I used Buddhist principles, Buddhist principles to explain about life and death. And that was so powerful. Yeah, this, it reminds me of the power of the Buddhist ideas. 250 people, and so many people afterwards, they came up to me and thanked me and said, wow, that was the best funeral service we have ever heard. Whenever we go to funeral service, we feel so sad, we feel so depressed. First time I felt inspired after the funeral service. I thought, wow. I was shocked. Usually I only talk to audiences who are Buddhist. Here, nobody was a Buddhist, but they had a very positive reaction to Buddhist ideas. And this was very beautiful, yeah, and it was very nice. And it reminded me that very often, all we have to do is to get the Buddhist ideas out there. And if people hear them, yeah, whether they're Buddhist or not, they're going to be inspired by these things because they are very profound, very natural, easy to understand ideas that everyone really can relate to. Even blooming Vikings in Norway, yeah. And so... So, and this is so, so I was very, that was one of the, also the nice things about doing this, is just as a reminder, very often what we have to do in Buddhism, we have to reduce the entry barriers. Yeah, if you are a Westerner and you come to kind of Buddhism the first time, it's like, whoa, this is scary, this might be a religion or a cult or something. I remember first time I came to a monastery, I was quite scared, yeah. A monastery is a scary place, and weird monks, all kinds of stuff. If you don't grow up with these things, which I didn't do, it was scary. Huh? And sometimes all we need to do is to reduce the entry barriers a little bit, have a little bit less rituals, a little bit less kind of weird stuff, and then we kind of it's easier for people to take on board these ideas and listen to what we have to do. Huh? Anyway, that was one of the things that came out of death contemplation. Weird stuff comes out of death contemplation sometimes. So for me, it was very powerful and very useful to have having done the death contemplation. And the things that I said at my father's funeral were very simple things that I say at all funerals. Things like the idea that instead of focusing on what you have lost, you focus on what you have been given, what you have been how that life has enriched you. Yeah, how without my father, my life wouldn't have been the same. How he has supported me and done things for me all this time. And now to rejoice and thank him for all that support. To focus on what I have gained rather than what I have lost when he parted away. It's a bit like having some kind of wonderful experience in life. Yeah, you have some kind of peak experience, maybe in meditation, some of you, or maybe some other kind of wonderful experience, some beautiful concert or something that you go to. A peak experience, which is when you have these experiences, it's like you get transported out of your normal self. Yeah, and you have something very different. And afterwards, you can think two ways afterwards. You can either be sad that you haven't got it anymore. That's focusing on the loss. Or you can be happy that your ordinary life is so grey in comparison. How fortunate I was to have that experience. And that is the right way also to think about human life. And when you think like that, you don't really grieve so much anymore. Yeah. Instead, you rejoice in what you have been given and how the whole experience has enriched you instead. So these are the sort of things that the Buddha probably, he was probably way beyond that. But when he thought about death, and this is actually some of the things that come out of the death contemplation. It goes much further than that. It moves you towards the spiritual life. It moves you towards taking kindness, taking meditation, taking wisdom, all of these things far more seriously here. Because you understand at the end of the day, what really matters are your spiritual qualities. On your deathbed, when you're about to pass away, and it's not that far away, yeah, it happens very quickly. I think about myself, jeepers, I'm getting old already. I just looked 20 yesterday, and now I'm already, I don't dare to say how old I am, it's kind of, whoa, so old, and so fast, yeah, death, whoa, coming hurtling like a train towards me, and then bang, suddenly when you're gone. If I make it to the end of this talk, I'll be lucky. See, you never know. Yeah, one day you're going to have a monk sitting and suddenly, bang, he's dead. that's going to be a really good experience. Very interesting when that happens. It's a real life kind of experience of death. So, but when you remember this, death can come at any time. It changes your priorities. On your deathbed, what you're going to remember is not what you have made in this life in terms of money, in terms of possessions, in terms of relationships. In fact, that's often going to be a hindrance, because the more you have focused on that, the harder it's going to be to die. Why? Because you are attached to those things. You spend so much time looking after that. When you die, all of that is going to have to go. So why are you going to spend all your time in this life building up things that you then have to give up again when you die? It's madness. Yeah, it's crazy. We spend all our time doing things that then you have to give up on your deathbed. You feel confused. You feel, what was the point? Did I waste my time? I did all this stuff and now I have to give it all up again. It's kind of crazy. It's like, you know, you rent a car and then you give up the rented car afterwards. In the meantime, you have attached to the car so much you can't give it up, the rental car. No, don't take the rental car away from me. But it's not yours. You rented it. Oh, yeah. Oh, you have a point. Yeah, it's a bit like that. So when we think like this, when we contemplate death in the right way, when we think about our deathbed, we actually start to value different things in life. We value the spiritual path. We understand that the spiritual life is what really matters. How we build up our heart and mind in this life, those are the qualities that you carry on with you into the future after you die. And that is the right outlook. And this is how the whole idea of death contemplation that the Buddha also used is a very powerful way to enhance the spiritual practice and to make you move forward in a good way. Anyway, that is all for today. That's just a warm-up for tomorrow. Tomorrow we get the real. That is how it all started out. So, we have a little bit more time before the candlelit procession. Eileen, shall we? If anyone has any questions or complaints or comments, please. This is your chance.
We don't accept complaints. So, questions, please.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for coming here to do our talk.
Ramali.
Ramali.
Anyway, that's okay. Whatever. Okay, yeah. Human being. That's, we all look the same, right? That's what they say sometimes. Please. Yeah.
So what I would like to ask is, like, it's not specific to death contemplation,
yeah,
but it's how do we actually contemplate on the various concepts of Buddhism?
How we contemplate on them, yeah?
On the concepts, yeah, of Buddhism.
Okay. One of the ways of doing that is actually to read the suttas a little bit, read the word of the Buddha, and then when you read of the Buddha, read the word of the Buddha, do it at a time when you have a bit of spare time, so you can stop a little bit, you can ask yourself, what does this mean in terms of my life? Yeah, these things. And this is one of the things that I specialize in. This is one when I take everyone to Batam Island. I recently went to Batam Island for 6 days. I specialize in, I just read the suttas, yeah? And I make a few comments as well, but I read the suttas and then try to make people reflect on the content of those suttas. That's kind of what I love doing, because the word of the Buddha to me is the inspiration for the entire spiritual path. So do that, yeah. And sometimes you can also listen to some of the teachings online, bswa.org, yeah, which is the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, where I come from. There's lots of sutta teachings online where you explain these teachings. What I was doing tonight was basically, you may not have noticed, but basically it was a sutta exposition. I was taking little bits from the suttas and explaining them, yeah. So basically, I was just teaching you the suttas in one way. That's kind of what I was trying to do anyway. So this is a way of doing this, reflecting on the word of the Buddha, because sometimes if you try to reflect too much independently, it can go astray. But if you use the suttas as a guideline, it means that you always have that thing that pulls you back in line to what actually matters and what is important. So that is one way of doing that. So Is that what you're asking about, or did you have something more specific in mind there? No? Is it okay? Yeah. So it's actually not very complicated. It's just to ask yourself, what does this mean for me here? How does it fit into my life? Okay, death. What does it actually mean that I'm going to die? And once you start to take this on board in a more profound sense, it starts to do something with you emotionally. And that is kind of the point there. Yeah. Okay.
Ajahn, thanks for the teaching today. Basically, I think Buddha, it just popped in my mind. Buddha see a problem with death. Mm. First of all, he must have the concept of rebirth. Am I right to say that?
It helps.
He must have believed that, the samsara exists. And if he don't resolve it, he's going to go through everything again. So in this perspective, isn't it right that we have to accept that rebirth is part of it? Although, we can't scientifically prove it as in now. But, if we don't do it in this lifetime, we might have to come back so many times.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It certainly helps. Yeah, and it's very, very useful. And I think the Buddha, he may have had some idea of rebirth already at that point. But what is also interesting about the Buddha, on his enlightenment night, or when he became enlightened or awakened, he also remembered his past lives. Yeah, so he wasn't satisfied with just believing in rebirth. He actually wanted to check it out. So he didn't actually specifically go to remember his past lives to make sure that his belief was accurate. And so for us, it's a similar kind of thing. Yes, okay, I think it is certainly right to have the idea of rebirth. It's a very, very important thing. And as you say, if you are on your deathbed and the idea is, well, what am I going to take with me into the future? Of course, it implies that you have an idea about rebirth. Yeah. So it's good to have that. I think as far as I'm concerned, it's a reality. there comes a point in also in our practice, where actually you want to see it for yourself rather than just believe it. So know that I have faith in this, I believe in it. Don't hold it too tightly. If you hold it too tightly, it means you're going to argue with other people. Other people can say, no, there is no rebirth. That's just an ancient Buddhist superstition. They're going to say that. And you're going to say, no, there is rebirth. I know. How do you know? Oh, the Buddha said so. Okay, prove it, or whatever. And then it goes on. So you, one of the points is to hold these things quite lightly in our lives, because in the end, we have to accept, most people, we don't know that there is rebirth, but we accept, take it on board as faith and confidence. So, yes.
Yeah, that's what I think. If we don't learn a lesson, we'll keep coming back and repeat the paper, just like examination.
Yeah.
We have to resit and resit again.
Yeah, and usually we fail the exam, exactly, that's the problem. Yeah, resit, exactly. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
No more questions?
I heard your story, Buddha never gotten married?
He never got married.
Yeah. And how about his clan, like Sakyamuni, comes from the Sakya, king's clan. Yeah. How
okay.
about his name?
Yeah. No, that wasn't really my point. That never got married. That wasn't really the point. Yeah. He's supposed to have a wife and a child. Yeah. And so that wasn't really the point. The point was just that he wasn't a bodhisattva before in a past life. Yeah. So he did it. When his parents cried when he left his parents. Then my point was just that he had made sure that his wife and child were looked after, because his parents would end up taking over looking after his wife and child. Yeah. So we know that he had a wife and child. We don't know if he had a wife necessarily, but he had some, you know, someone who was the mother of his child. We don't know exactly who that mother was. It's uncertain. It's not actually said anywhere, so it's very, very hard to know. But we know that he had a son. That seems to be fairly clear. Yeah. So he had those things. And yes, he was part of the Sakyan clan. He grew up in the Sakyan kingdom. His father was one of the chieftains of the Sakyan kingdom. His father was called the Sakyan. And the Buddha was called Sakyamuni. I don't think he was called that in the early suttas, but he was called... all the monks were called Sakyaputas, the sons of the Sakyan. So the Buddha was a Sakyan, they were all the sons of the Sakyan. Or Sakyadita, perhaps, the daughters of the Sakyan. Is that what you... Am I answering your question, or am I... Yeah? Are you okay? Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, no. All I'm saying is that it has been blown out of proportions in later literature, and the basics are correct, but in later Buddhism it has been blown out to make this kind of enormous kingdom, and everything is kind of gold and glitter and very beautiful. But actually, it was quite humble. That's all I'm saying here. It was much more humble in reality, because one of the tendencies in Buddhism is to glorify the Buddha as much as possible, and we can see that in later Buddhist history that this glorification process kind of takes off, and the later you go in Buddhism, the more glorified everything is. And this, but actually not the way it was in the earlier suttas. That's all I'm saying here. Yeah.
Thank you for the talk, Arjun. So, near the end, you talked about how it doesn't make sense. If we're going to die someday, we should build up like relations and belongings. So,
yeah.
What would the ideal life to be? Live a life without any belongings, relationships, all of this.
Yeah. Good. No, that's a very good question. Thank you for that. It's a very important question, because what is the alternative? Yeah. What can we actually do? And the main thing is that we start to live differently. Yeah, you think about life in a different way. You don't necessarily have to do anything different. You can still actually have relationships and an ordinary job and all of these kind of things. But you think about that relationship and a job in a new way. Usually, very often, when people think about their world life, they think about how can I get the most, yeah? And how can I kind of become more famous or more well-known or more well-liked and have all the right connections and all of these kind of worldly things that we're trying to build up in our life. But then you realize that actually far more important than all the things we get, all the results that we achieve, is how we get to those results. The process is what matters. The results are not so important. So, yes, you may have a relationship. Yes, you may have a job. You may even have a very successful job. But more important than the success and the actual fact of the relationship is how you deal with those things, that you deal with them with kindness. You deal with them with generosity, with compassion, and with understanding. Because when you deal with those things in the right way, you're building up your spiritual qualities. Yeah, so your focus becomes different. And if you don't meet your targets of making so and so much money or whatever, it doesn't matter so much. You don't really care so much about that anymore. It's not so important to you, because you have the inner qualities instead. And you understand these are the qualities that really matter. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I have seen many miserable rich people in my life. And I think, what's the point of being, if you are sad inside, what's the point of being wealthy? Surely the inner happiness is far more important than the external happiness, or the external wealth rather. Yeah, if you can't be happy inside, especially if as part of your life you kind of take shortcuts, yeah, you do immoral things, you cheat other people and whatever. A lot of business people do that because they have to kind of cut corners a little bit. And then not only do you build up all this wealth that you have to give up when you die, but even you feel bad about yourself on your deathbed. You feel bad, I did all these bad things. And now I have to give up all those things that I did bad things to get. Wow, it's madness. Yeah, it's crazy. And now all I have now is the remorse and the sadness in my heart that I did bad things. And all the things I gained from that, I have to give up. You can see the problem. Yeah, it's a really, really bad problem. And of course, the point is also that if you take this to the kind of the extreme and you really want to follow the spiritual path fully, then sometimes some people also decide to become monks, because that is where, or nuns, that's where you can really sometimes take these things all the way to the full practice. Not sure what your parents will say, but anyway, that's the so anyway, so there you are. Anything else anyone wants to say here?
One last question before we do the candlelight. Oh, that's one.
Yes, one last question.
Oh, no, that's two more. Okay. Two last questions. Second yours last and question. The ladies.
Okay.
So, Ajahn.
Where are you?
I'm here.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for the talk.
Yeah.
So, back to some of your words, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how do we know that we are practicing right? I mean, half the time we're probably sleeping during meditation. how would we know that, you know, we're better off than where we started? Thank you.
Okay, that's another very important question. And that's a question that the Buddha answers directly in the suttas. And it's a very, very important one. And the answer is that you should look at yourself over a period of time and to see whether your good qualities are improving and your bad qualities are declining. So you should take a good time span, like 6 months or a year, and you should look at things like mindfulness, at basically your kindness, your goodness of heart, whether you feel, you know, more kind, inclined towards other people, whether your level of anger and irritation is going down. This is the sort of thing that you look at. So in Buddhism, good qualities are kindness, compassion, mindfulness, stillness in meditation, and all of these kind of things. And the bad ones are the greed and the confusion and the restlessness and the anger, especially anger and irritation is a really big one you need to look out for. So you look and you see whether these things are heading in the right direction. If they are, over substantial periods of time, let's say you go on a meditation retreat once a year, that's a good time to check what's happening inside of you, then you're on the right track. But if you are not making any improvement over those time spans, then you have to ask yourself why. And sometimes you have to be brutally honest with yourself, to see your weaknesses or whatever they are. And that is the way to improve. And then you will find that weakness, you will undo it, and then you start making progress again. So thank you for that question.
My question is, is chanting really necessary for practicing Buddhism?
Is it necessary to practice Buddhism? I think saying it necessary would be a massive exaggeration. But it can be useful. Yeah, it can be useful. And that is really the point, I think. So if you use chanting, let's say that chanting makes you feel a bit more peaceful. Let's say you have a job, you work. Okay, so let's say you come back from work and you feel a bit stressed out. Do you feel stressed at work sometimes? Do you feel stressed at work sometimes? Yeah, so like most people, sometimes you get a bit stressed. And sometimes when you come back home, it can be difficult to sit down straight away and do meditation practice or whatever. Do a bit of chanting here. Or put on a little, or listen to some chanting. Someone else doing that chanting or whatever. Just to make you feel a bit more relaxed and at ease. You can put on any kind of music if you like. Doesn't have to be chanting, but if Buddhist chanting speaks to you, you can do that. But if you put on music, don't put on heavy metal or anything like that. Put on something peaceful that makes you feel at ease. That's the right kind of music. So remember, it is we use things in our life, in our world, to make the mind lean in the right direction. So always ask yourself what it does to you. If it has a beneficial effect, then it's useful. Chanting, where it comes from? It comes from the idea of reciting the suttas, reciting the word of the Buddha. So a lot of the chanting is actually very beautiful. If you know the Metta Sutta, for example, in English, Karaniya Mata Kusalena, and you do it in English, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and all of that. Actually, it's very beautiful. And when you do that, and you chant that, and you feel inspired by the content, that is really what it is for. So sometimes all you have to do is you can chant it in Pali, and then you know the meaning in the meaning of it. Actually, in the Mahayana chant, they often chant in Mandarin, right? Isn't that right? Yeah. So you know, if you speak Mandarin, you can actually understand it straight away. That's quite handy. Yeah. But hopefully they chant the right kind of sutras. Yeah, that's all. No, I'm being naughty now. So just so. Everything should have a point. Nothing is kind of like a miracle cure that works on its own. And as long as you use it in a good way to improve yourself and make your life better, then you're doing it in the right way. You okay with that answer? Yeah? Okay. She's happy. Good. Now the customer is satisfied. That's okay.
No more questions? I have some announcements before we go down for the candlelight procession. Tomorrow, it's at Chui Hui Lin Club, the Visa celebrations. Please be there at before 8:45 and be seated. Then after that, we will start the opening speeches and taking the three refuges and five precepts, and then the Dhamma talk on the Buddha is the best. And then of course we have Ajahn Ramali and Aya Suki going round for Pindachara, the arms round. And we have Vesak performances at lunchtime, 12 o'clock, and the offering of the Sangha requisites. So do join us at Chui Hui Lin Club. Not here. Don't turn out here. The doors will be locked. And have one that is for youth. Ages 10 to 14. So if parents have youth or teenagers between ages 10 to 14, there's a camp, Rahula camp for them from June 28th to 29th at the camp will be here, and they have team building, outdoor games, mindfulness activities, and all the exciting activities. So please sign up. The closing date is actually end of this month.